Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And we're live at your place today. How are you, Michael?
Very good. How's your week gone?
It's been very, very busy. Busy at the magazine?
Sure is. And a nice big show planned for today.
Fantastic. On today's program, we're chatting with the Red Cross in a few moments' time.
We sure are. And also the global CEO of Insight Vacation. He's talking about all the new travel trends that are
really
happening.
Really cool. And Dan England is going to join us. Stroke survivor. He's gone through a couple of pairs of joggers on this long trip that he's been doing.
He sure is. And we're off to Floreat in Canberra. And of course, we're also got our food editor on, and she's talking all about blood oranges.
I know, so it's one of those types of shows. And of course, for more details, jump onto mindfood.com, and the new iApp is up and running as well, so you can also listen to our podcasts.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
Now, do you have a first aid kit at home?
We do, because we have three children.
Oh, you do?
And I have to say, yeah. I think anyone with kids, you know, well, perhaps ours is more a medical kit than a first aid kit, but, you know, it has a bit of everything
in
there.
Yeah.
And if anything happens, we tend to run there first. And, of course, to be honest, you know, the plasters have been used for some school project,
whatever. Yeah. But it's a survival kit.
Exactly.
I went through mine the other day and I discovered that most of the stuff is out of date.
Is
I haven't updated it for... Yeah, well, you just presume because you've never used it, it's always going to be fresh.
Well, Red Cross encourages Australians to update their first aid skills, and we've actually got on the line the training manager from South Australia, Daniel Code. Hi, Daniel. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're at the Red Cross College. I didn't even know that there was such a thing. What do they do at the Red Cross College?
Well, Red Cross is primarily, or has been, the largest provider of first aid training internationally. And the Red Cross College found there was a need for community services and aged care business. So we're basically turned into a vocational education training as well as first aid.
It's interesting. When I recently did a CPR training course. Why is it that after you do these types of courses, you think, I'm going to forget all this stuff? And then when something does happen, you sort of go, I've been in a panic before when something like that does happen, because I think, I've done the training, but why am I doubting myself?
No, that's a normal response, unless you do it all the time. It's not something you want to do all the time.
No.
It's a normal response, and all you can do is sort of rely on what you've been taught. The greatest thing is just to have a go. Especially with CPR, if someone's had a heart attack, the best thing you do is just have a go.
But don't you think, I'd be nervous I'd get it wrong.
No, well, as long as you get your hands about the right spot and you've got the compression rate about the right time, then, look, any form of CPR is better than nothing.
So with regard to a home, first aid kit, how often should we be updating that? You know, like has been said before, you know, he sort of went back and looked at his and everything was out of date.
Me personally, I check my, well, I'm supposed to look at different background, but I check mine every 6 months. I'll go through it from top to bottom, and if I need anything, I just go on the website, Red Cross website, and order back in what I need.
Now tell me, Daniel, do you reckon everybody that's a tradesman should have a little first aid kit on them as part of their daily routine?
In South Australia, under the works thing, that a lot of the tradesmen do have a first aid kit, but then what do you put in your first aid kit?
Yeah.
So really you need to do a sort of a risk analysis about what sort of injuries you may have or inflict on yourself. In my previous life before Red Cross, I've seen guys hold rather nasty gashes together with duct tape.
I've seen that.
Until the ambulance shows up. And those sorts of things. So think outside the square. If you've got a nice clean T-shirt and some duct tape, you're laughing if you cut yourself.
Yeah. Because if you're on a bushwalk, you're not going to have all the luxuries, are you?
No, you're not going to have the luxuries. You need to know if someone's broken their wrist or their leg or how to build a splint out of some bits of newspaper.
If that happened to Michael and I, could you imagine which tree would we lean on to break the branch off to help somebody?
But, you know, I am actually quite good in a crisis. I tend to cut to the chase read it well, quick, and then act
straight into it.
Yeah.
So what should we do? Do we go online and buy? Is there a basic kit we can buy?
Look, Red Cross has got a stack of kits, all specifically for either the small packs for out bushwalking. There's one to just have in your car. There's a household pack. Yeah, and keep it where it's accessible for your smaller children.
Yeah.
Because if you're out busy looking after one, then you can send the little in to get the first aid kit.
Fantastic. That's a great idea. Well, thank you, Daniel.
Hey, you're more than welcome.
Okay, mate, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye. The training manager there for South Australia Red Cross College, really interesting information.
And it's one of those things you never really think
about.
Until, as I said,
until it happens, yeah. And then you go, where's the first aid kit?
Or you've got a school project.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
Michael, you love travelling.
I do love travel.
You've got the travel bug all the time.
And it's a big component of Mind Food in terms of online and with the new app and the magazine. And I'm very lucky because I get to meet lots of very interesting people around the world and in terms of the travel industry.
Yep.
And on today's show, I'd like to welcome the global CEO of Insight Vacations, John Baldwin. Hi, John.
Hello there.
Now, your company takes people on holiday. It's a wonderful thing you do and provide, really, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's a business I've been involved in pretty much most of my working career, and it's something I very much love. And like you, I love travel too. I mean, it's a, goodness me, providing vacations for people has to be the best job in the world, I think.
Exactly. It's kind of interesting. I know we've just had a conversation today in terms of the growth areas, and I was really surprised to hear that Greece, funnily enough, is kind of a big growth area for you.
Yeah, I saw some stats very recently, actually, yesterday, that were saying that traffic out of the UK to Greece has grown 10%. Well, we're a global operator, and I can tell you we're seeing growth too, right across the board.
Yeah.
So people are understanding, I think, that, you know, whilst you may see things on the TV news or whatever it might be, you know, when you're a tourist, you're not being affected by those things. It's still fantastic as a destination.
Yeah, it is a beautiful spot. Now, for Australian and New Zealanders, you know, we love to travel and we travel long distances. Are you finding, though, when we go all that way, perhaps to somewhere like Europe, we tend to do back-to-back options in terms of travel?
Yeah, probably 30% of our people, Michael, do that. They join a couple of tours together very often. There are price advantages in doing that too, but people do tend to do that. Yes, they'll pick a destination. It might be the UK or whatever, and then they'll tack another sector onto it as well. So perhaps enjoy a vacation in Italy, joined with it, or a tour around Europe or something like that. Yes.
And for Insight, where are you seeing the growth in terms of new areas opening up? You know, where are the trends in travel?
Yeah, well, this is the bit I really love, because what we've done over the years is to add so many peripheral destinations to the central core of Europe. And what we've really seen is big growth in Eastern Europe, for example. You know, we've got products now and people really travelling in good numbers down to the Ukraine, to the Crimea, you know, part of the semi-autonomous region of the Ukraine, on the Black Sea, up to the Golden Ring of Russia. My goodness, this is where all the monasteries are and the great Kremlins of Russia. This area northeast of Moscow, we do a little extension there for our Easy Pace Russia that comprises St. Petersburg and Moscow. So fantastic stuff like that. Another area, of course, is up in the north, Iceland, or right down into Portugal or Morocco or wherever it might be. So east, north, south, west. You know, we've sort of got it covered.
If we're sitting at home today thinking, oh, we've got a few dimes in the cupboard here, or our holidays are coming up, what do you recommend we look at doing?
Well, I tell you where I would absolutely consider going is going to the Iberian Peninsula at the moment. You know, that's a pretty much year-round thing, and there's a lot of product there, even in the wintertime, the European wintertime, so your summertime. And we see loads of people going down, enjoying a vacation from Madrid through to Barcelona and touching into these great cities like Seville and Granada and so on. And northern Spain, you know, that's really grown across the Basque country, San Sebastian to Santander, through the Way of St. James and down to places like Oviedo and my goodness, down into Portugal, Porto and so on.
Exotic.
I'd go there.
It makes you want to go, doesn't it?
It's so exotic. Yeah. Thanks for your insights today, John. I tell you what, really, really cool stuff.
And the thing is, people love to hear the latest trends in travel. You know, they always want to know where to go to stay, where to go for holidays. So thanks a lot for being on the show.
Absolute pleasure. Lovely to talk to you.
There you have it.
I know. So where are you going for your next holiday,
Rome?
Ben?
So Vermont.
I love the idea of Russia, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
God,
yeah,
that'd be cool.
Actually, I'd love to just do that one day, just get to the end of the week and go, you know what, let's just get out of here. Bang.
Well, we've got a story coming up in a new edition of Mind Food, and it's all about adults who have been sexually abused as children. And this is a subject out in society that perhaps is not discussed as much as it should be because the numbers are huge. And I'd like to welcome to the show Sophie today. Hi, Sophie.
Hello. Hi.
Now, your story is extraordinary. You were abused as a child, and I'd like you to perhaps take us back to that time and tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Well, I was born in England, as you can hear from my accent, I'm sure, and we're a very large family, six children, and a family with an alcoholic father and a very, very busy and unhappy mother. And within that, my father chose me as a favourite and in some ways sort of spoused me, made me his primary, his relationship. And within that, there was a lot of, within the whole family, what I term covert sexual abuse, in that there were absolutely no boundaries in our family, no locked doors, we knew far too much about my parents' marriage, the ins and outs of what was going on.
Did the did your brothers and sisters know that you were your father's favourite?
Oh, absolutely. It was incredibly overt. Including for my mother too. So that separated me out from my siblings and my mother, and enabled that relationship to carry on. In addition to that, my father had a business partner when I was about six, who he used to drink a lot with, and this man raped me, which is something that I never told anybody, and still to this day have not actually told my family about that. So there was a lot of no safety at all.
And so how long did the abuse actually last for?
It started when I was three, but it stopped when I was 10. I got sent to boarding school when I was 10, so I was out of the family system and away from my father's business partner.
In terms of moving through your life, you then actually went on and, the job you now have and the training you have done is fairly extraordinary, isn't it, in terms of, how you help people. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, I was fortunate enough to go into therapy when I was very young, when it wasn't a recognised or acceptable form of support. I've been able to make massive changes in my relationships, feeling safe in the world, and loving and respecting myself. And as a result of that, I've always said, really, in some ways, therapy saved my life. It certainly, in many ways, saved me for wanting to carry on living this life, but it saved my life in transforming how I am in my world. And as a result of that, I wanted very much to be able to offer that support to other people. So I started training in my late 20s and have been working as a sex therapist for nearly 25 years.
So for people listening today, and perhaps they have been abused as children, or they know of someone who perhaps was abused as a child, where can they go to get help?
Well, hopefully, they, like myself, will have friends and people in their life, even family members, who they can be getting a lot of support from. There are also a lot of books now. The Courage to Heal is a wonderful book for helping people who are recovering from childhood sexual abuse.
Sophie, thank you very much for being on the show today. I know your story will have helped many, many people.
I hope so too, and thank you very much.
Visit mindfood.com today. Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking.
Well, welcome back. It's Mind Food Radio with Ben and Michael. Now, a couple of weeks ago, Dan England, I tell you what, he put on those walking shoes and he was going on a very long walk.
He just didn't stop. Now, we've actually had him on the show. He was well into it. I think he was about halfway through the big walk.
And he's a stroke survivor.
That's right. And that's why he's doing it. And of course, next week is the stroke week here in Australia. So I said, we've got to get him back on the show because he's circling the outskirts of Brisbane as we speak.
And with a stroke of good luck, we've actually got him on the line.
Uh-huh. Maha. How are you, Dan?
How are you, guys?
Now, listen, Ben asked you how many shoes I remember in the last interview you went through. How are they looking now?
They look all right, but I don't think they're wore out yet.
Oh, oh wow. So you got through in one pair?
No, nah, 3.5, I said.
There you go. Yeah, there you
three
go.
And a half. I've got to have a pair to go home in. So.
And how are you holding up?
Better than I thought. I think my my left leg from the stroke is probably fatigued, to say the least.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, with a bit of good physiotherapy in Dolby, we come through.
So the psychology of it all, you know, like, I've got to ask, halfway through, did you go a bit nuts?
About 60%, I thought, oh, man, this is a long ways. mentally, I think it's probably, you're just pulling on basically, I pulled through the stroke, I can pull through this. And people at the Stroke Foundation, too, have been really good on our Facebook page to encourage you along the way because, you know, they're finding strength and inspiration through what we're doing. So yeah. It works both ways.
What have you learned about yourself from doing this?
If you put your mind over the pain, you can get over it. You know, whether it's 1 kilometer or one day, you can maybe feel better tomorrow. So you always feel better after you get over it.
yeah, that's funny that, isn't it?
Yeah, if you get over the pain, if you get over that hard day, yeah. Tomorrow's a day off, and then you sort of forget about it. So it's just hard to see past tomorrow, isn't it?
And what about the reception when you've come into towns and stuff? What's that all been like, and what have people been saying to you?
It's been really special, you know. There's been stroke survivors along the way who, you know, there was a lady in Tarum who was 29 years post-stroke. You don't hear stories about stroke from 29 years ago, but man, has it changed. And, you know, she was shifted from hospital to hospital, and they still didn't know what she had. And I thought, gosh, you know, how far is it now? You wouldn't be transferred from a hospital with a stroke. Back then, she just had a young junior nurse pick that she had a stroke. And her story was so special because you can just see what, you know, the National Stroke Foundation plus the hospital's education about stroke, it's just come so much further since then. So, yeah, those stories are really meaningful.
Dan, it's interesting to note that, you know, you don't sort of plan to have a stroke, but, I mean, you've done this to raise the awareness. So what are some of the symptoms that people should look out for, and what should you do if you think you're having a stroke?
Well, the first four letters are probably the best thing, and that is the word FAST, you know, face, arm, speech, and time. You need any of the four letters. You can have the F for face, facial numbness or dragging, where your face hangs down. Arm, your arm feels heavy or numb like mine did. I couldn't lift my arm. Speech, someone might just all of a sudden have slurred speech. The T is for time. If you get to the hospital fast enough, you can have what they call a reverse stroke. And basically, you can reverse a blood clot within hours if you get there quick enough. So those are the signs of stroke. To prevent it, it's the Know Your Numbers campaign that the Stroke Foundation do push, and that is cholesterol, blood pressure, and diabetes. You need to know what your numbers are. If you're anything over, I would say myself, anything over 40, you need to know what your numbers are because that will prevent a stroke.
Well, it's a great story, and congratulations.
Thank you very much, you guys. And, you know, let's spread the word for Stroke Week this year, and we can do something about it. Let's look at ourselves and get our bloods checked, and I think we can reduce this number of strokes in the country.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
Well, it's that time of the year again. Be spring-inspired at Floriade 2012, where dazzling garden beds, horticultural delights, engaging demonstrations and fun activities. They've all been inspired by this year's theme, style and design. And with us on the line, we've got Andrew Foster joining us, who is the head gardener at Floriade. How are you, Andrew?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Are you out amongst all the tulips yet, or are they still growing?
I've been out there today, and I've been chasing cockatoos away today, and we've been planting around, doing replants, filling in a few holes, and our team's been working on our display garden as well, which looks fantastic.
Now, that must be pretty daunting, because I think there's something like over 1 million bulbs and annuals, but when you start many months ago, and it's just a blank canvas, do you ever scratch your head and think, oh, God, here we go, what's it going to look like?
Basically, we start, as you say, with a blank canvas, and we mark out the outline of the garden beds. And then once we do that, then we put in all the pathways, and we've got a coloured map and large A1 plan, so we can see on the plan to what's on the ground, and
yep.
It looks It looks wonderful.
What do you like about doing this as a job?
The people that you get to work with, seeing the bulbs come through and grow from like seedlings or from bulbs right through to when they flower. The people from Canberra after coming out after a cold winter and having a look at the flowers in springtime, it's an awesome time. It's like the people coming out from under their doonas, the flowers do the same.
Now, last year you had a special guest, the Queen visited, and you took her around the garden. What did she say to you about it?
She was really interested in the mass plantings, and she pointed out the English daisies to me, and she really liked those.
Mm-hmm.
That was a wonderful experience.
Was she nice to talk to?
Yes, she was. She was very laid back and interested in what we've been doing, and it was good.
She didn't ride the 35-metre Ferris wheel, I take it?
No, she didn't have time for that. She got to walk through the kitchen garden and talk to the people at War Memorial, and I walked her through. She met Michael Wood, the floral designer. It was a really good experience.
So this year, what is the design? Is there a particular design that we're looking at?
The theme is Be Spring Inspired, style and design. So it's based around style and design. So there's martini glasses up in the top, one of the top garden beds. There's a garden bed called Psychedelia. There's a garden bed with lipstick kisses in it.
There's
a French formal garden bed. There's a garden bed with stilettos in it. A garden bed with hair fashion. So there's like a picture of a head with the hair flowing out.
Sounds like you've gone very fashion this year.
That's right. And there's a diamonds and pearls garden bed.
Oh, really?
And there's actually, in that garden bed, they're raised up. So there's some mounds which represent the diamonds and the pearls. And that's giving a three-dimensional aspect.
And how many people are you expecting through this year?
Oh, last year they had 410,000 people through the gate. So
that's a lot, isn't it?
That's over the month. So starting this year, it starts on the 15th of September and goes to the 14th of October.
Fantastic. And then what do you do after it all?
Afterwards, on the last night, the Sunday night once it closes, the volunteers that help at Floriade get to have a dig and take some bulbs home. And on the Monday morning, we take some of the bulbs and they go to parks around Canberra and dropped around some of the parks in some of the areas in Commonwealth Park.
Yep.
And then the park, all the soil gets taken away.
Mm.
And they screen it and they resell it as a Floriade mix.
Mm-hmm.
And then the park has to go back to grass again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so by Christmas time, the park's back to a park again.
Isn't that amazing?
And then we start again next year. have a holiday and start again next year.
Well, Andrew, thank you very much for joining us on today's program.
No worries at all.
Fantastic. Andrew Forster there, the head gardener at Floriade. We'll have to go down there, Michael.
It's beautiful, Canberra, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is. And they've got that fantastic National Gallery.
They do.
It's worth a trip.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking. The perfect gift idea is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
Well, she's run off to get the glasses put on. The food director is now picking up the magazine. We're into the world of blood oranges.
I know. Have you had them before?
I love them.
Do you?
I do, yeah.
Do you know what I've noticed in cafes, particularly the very fancy?
Oh, yeah, they're everywhere.
Aren't they?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's not just, you know, do you want an orange?
No.
It's now
it's a blood orange.
Yeah, it's become very...
It's the vogue fruit of the season.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think we should call it the mind food fruit of the season because welcome to the show, Michelle.
Crazy today, Andrew.
Oh, well, it's the orange.
It's the blood oranges in us.
Oh, it's all that, all the good nutritional value of those blood oranges, making you feel good.
Well, I guess they're full of vitamin C, obviously, aren't they?
Yes, they've got lots of vitamin C, calcium and vitamin A, and lots of antioxidants and fibre as well.
They look beautiful, though, don't they? You know, like
yeah,
we've
they
got
do.
That gorgeous shot in the magazine and cut like that. They really do look quite beautiful.
They're a beautiful fruit, and they're in season now until October. So hop out to the shops and get yourself just some blood oranges or pick them off your tree, because now's the perfect time for harvesting.
Mm.
The weather's got warmer and we've had the colder months, so harvest the last of your blood oranges, and we've got some great recipes for you.
So what are we cooking today with them then?
Well, today as you said, Michael, it's a versatile fruit. We've got three choices. We've got the blood orange curd pancakes or crepes with ice cream and burnt butter sauce.
Yum.
We've got a beautiful Shrewsbury biscuit with a blood orange jam. And then we've got a beautiful blood orange and almond phyllo tart.
I could eat all of those. I would never think of baking an orange. I would never think, I know, Michael's salivating.
I'm actually licking these.
He's still...
No, but if you
you're
think
still
about
on the
it,
icing sugar page.
That's quite something, like a blood orange curd. Oh, I've never heard of it. But imagine that. You could put that on more than just the the
crepe
or the pancake.
But I didn't know you could bake them. I've never thought of doing that.
I wonder if like an orange with an orange cake, you know, a normal orange cake.
So. Yeah. Come on, you're always making duck
I'm such a cook, as you know, Michelle.
Duck a la ronge.
Duck a la ronge. Duck under the table.
Now, the blood orange shrewsbury biscuits, they look absolutely beautiful. The jam, is that easy to make?
The jam is very easy to make. It's just a matter of getting, we've incorporated some raspberries, so it's just a matter of getting the, 5 blood oranges and some raspberries and sugar and just cooking that down until, you know, until it thickens and separates on the back of a spoon. So that's an easy one.
Mm, yum.
But I thought, Michael, you'd be choosing those blood orange curd crepes with ice cream and burnt butter sauce. That's got you written all over.
I know, it has. Well, on a Saturday, I make pancakes for the kids. You know, that's kind of my thing. All right, and
Michael he's actually quite funny in the kitchen. I like watching Michael in the kitchen. He really takes control, doesn't he, Michelle?
I do.
He likes to be constantly cleaning the bench.
Yeah, he is.
Do you know, we went out for dinner the other night, Michelle
and I
was
your oven is still there, the way he slams the door. 5 more minutes.
We went out to dinner and we ordered dessert. And the couple we were with, Jimmy and Sue, and Jimmy said to me, "You are the tidiest dessert eater." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Look how you're eating that dessert." But I didn't want to muck it up, and
it's
so beautiful.
Well, to make the blood orange curd, it's just a matter of placing some sugar, yolks into a heat-proof bowl, and then simmering them over some hot water until the sugar dissolves and the mixture is light and fluffy.
Yep.
And then you slowly add the juice of the orange, or the blood orange, and then incorporate the butter. And then you set that aside.
Okay, when you make a crepe, should you put butter or oil in the pan?
Butter.
Yes. Of course, it's all on page 103 of this month's magazine, so you can always go there and read the recipe.
But what are some tips? Give us some tips.
Well, really the big tip is with crepes is not to overmix the batter, because otherwise it will toughen the mixture. And also, I like to cover the batter and just let it to stand in the fridge for, 20, 30 minutes. And that allows all the flour particles to expand and you'll get a better batter. So a better pancake, a better crepe in the end.
Mm, yum.
Now, what sort of flour are you using? Self-raising or plain?
Just plain flour.
Yeah. They look so simple, though. You know, like making curd and the jam, they are very simple recipes to make.
They are. We like to make it simple but interesting.
Have a nice afternoon.
Okay, you too.
Talk to you next week. Bye. Bye.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
For more details, jump onto mindfood.com on any of the topics we've spoken about today. We're now heading into the world of sexuality and gender, and we've got a specialist and a sociologist joining us now on the program.
We have. I'd like to welcome to the show Paul McCann. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you going?
Now, you're the head of academic studies at Jensen Newman Institute, which specialises in counselling and psychotherapy.
Yes.
It's a big mouthful, isn't it?
It's huge.
So tell us, in terms of your role, we're going to talk a little bit about marriage equality today.
Sure.
So tell us your views on that.
I think it's inevitable that it will happen in Australia when you see someone like the British Prime Minister, who's from the Conservative Party, saying that he supports gay marriage because to him it's strengthening the institution of marriage, and that to him as a conservative viewpoint, it's inevitable that it will kind of filter through to other Western democracies. Convention in America for the Democrat Party has just endorsed same-sex marriage, as did Barack Obama 3 or 4 weeks ago. So there is quite a momentum about this. Of course, the irony in Australia is we have an unmarried atheist female prime minister who, for some strange reason, can't quite get her head around it.
Mm. Is it just politics, though? Is she just playing politics?
I think so. I really would love to sit down with her and have an honest conversation about what her block is. Is she really so socially conservative about such a topic? And if so, how does she align that with the fact that she doesn't feel the need to be in a standard marriage herself and yet, of course, wants to have her relationship with Tim recognised?
Mm. I think, though, perhaps, she doesn't want to upset anyone, does she?
And so she's taking this wishy-washy middle ground, and she's alienating people who support gay marriage, and she's, by other policies that she's putting up, alienating people who don't support anything that the left would ever propose. She's in a very strange position.
I think you're right, though, in that, you've got Obama and Cameron and everyone, the ball is moving and it's starting to
but
roll.
Is it fear? Do you think it's fear that she's scared of making the wrong decision? Or?
It shouldn't be, because she has managed to show leadership on other contentious issues like the carbon tax, but perhaps this is just seen as a bridge too far. But really, this it shouldn't come down to politics. This is a human rights issue, and it does, from a counselling perspective, it does have a major impact on people's emotional health when you're in a relationship that's not recognised or has this second tier of recognition of something wishy-washy like civil partnerships. Yeah. It doesn't actually say that the relationship you're in is valued by the community.
But politics has got nothing to do with it. You know, like, at the end of the day, it's hard to believe we're even discussing this. It's a basic human right, isn't
it?
You know?
But from what you see in, say, a counselling scenario, what would be the throwback to this? What would happen for people?
The fact is that people's relationships aren't valued, and therefore there's this sense that you're not perhaps seen as valid a person in the eyes of the rest of the country or in the eyes of your immediate family or whatever part of society that you're in.
I think it's sad, though, that we still sometimes have to play that game. You know, if people are gay or they can't sort of be who they are in a straight world.
Yeah, but then if you also look at the massive changes that have happened in Western democracies since the 1960s, the idea of decriminalising homosexuality was a radical idea when the Wolfenden Report came out in Britain in 1967, and yet within 20 years, most Western democracies had decriminalised. 10 or 15 years ago, if you'd said, sure, same-sex sex is no longer a criminal activity, but the idea of marriage between two men or two women would have been absolutely outrageous. And now it's a very common topic in political discourse. And a lot of the discussion is about why are we even hesitating about this. It's the obvious next step towards equality.
Paul McCann, very interesting discussion. And it's the sort of discussions we like at Mind Food Radio because it gets the old grey matter thinking. So thank you very much for being on the show.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for your time.
Good stuff.
Fantastic. Really interesting topic. It's Mind Food Radio. We like to read, Michael.
We sure do.
You like to write? You hang out with some cool people.
We sure do. And Jimmy Thompson I met actually on a Famil. He's a very cool guy, and he's written an amazing book. It's called A Sapper's War. Welcome to the show, Jimmy.
Hi, how are you?
Very, very good. Now, this is an amazing story about the sappers in Vietnam. And for our listeners today who actually don't know what a sapper is, just fill us in first about that.
Okay, a sapper is basically an infantryman, a soldier, but he's also an engineer. I mean, and they have their own regiment, the Royal Australian Engineers. But their job is to go in, they carry guns and they shoot people and they get shot at and all the rest of it. But they also have to build things and blow things up and fix booby traps and things like that.
So they're sort of like the tunnel rats, aren't they? They're the bridge builders and the mine clearers. And
Yeah. I mean, the tunnel rats were all sappers. And in fact, the original tunnel rats were a small Australian troop, three field troop, who were in at the early days of the Vietnam War, before conscription and all that, and they were really sent out there to build a camp for the Australian troops that were coming over. But while they were there, they discovered the Viet Cong tunnels.
Yeah. Now, they're a pretty special breed of soldier, though, really, aren't they? Because they lived pretty hard and played hard.
Very much so. They're very pragmatic people, generally speaking, you know, and they're also, well, you know, the sappers in the Vietnam War had the highest casualty rate of any Australian unit. So it's not like they were, you know, sitting around, you know, and twiddling their thumbs while everybody else got involved in the action. So they have a fairly pragmatic view of life, you know, and they get on with stuff, but when they've got the free time, they enjoy themselves, there's no doubt about that.
So Jimmy, how did you come to writing about all this?
Well, first of all, many years ago, I was asked to write the personal memoir of Sandy McGregor, who was, as a young captain, led that troop, three field troop, and then last year, I rewrote it as a third person military history called Tunnel Rats. And that's been so successful that this year we brought out a second book looking at all the engineers throughout the war, not just the tunnel rats.
Now, he actually finished as a colonel in the end, didn't he, in the reserves?
Yeah, and he won the military, now let me get this right, the Military Cross, which is reserved for officers. So, you know, he was a very distinguished military career. Indeed.
And with his experiences, you know, being at the front line like that, was he, you know, 30 years on, I think he was in the army for 30 years, was he scarred by it all?
Look, Sandy has a really interesting, a tragically interesting history. I mean, his experiences in Vietnam were enough for any one person to deal with. But later in life, his three teenage daughters were killed by, you know, it was an awful incident, but somebody came around to their house and killed them. And and he has had to learn to deal with that. And as a result of his ability to deal with that, he has his own organization called CALM, C-A-L-M, which he then, I mean, I don't know too much about it, but I know that it's a kind of relaxation, meditation, self-hypnosis thing that he does.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting, isn't it? I think, you know, as a book, I've just started to read it, and it's just absolutely fascinating. You certainly take, you know, the reader into a world that, it's written so well, you do kind of feel you're there. You know, the research is so good in it. So well done, Jimmy.
Thank you very much. Yeah. That's good to hear.
Great book. So A Sapper's War, Jimmy Thompson with Sandy McGregor, out now. And for more details, go to mindfood.com. So, Jimmy, where can we get the book?
Well, you know, all good bookshops, as they say. But we have our own website. It's www.sapperswar.com, sapperswar.com, and there you can find out more about the books, and we take tours to Vietnam and things like that.
Fantastic.
So there's a lot of information there.
Well, that's the end of the program. Now, I'm going to talk for a little bit because Michael's having some nuts. He just couldn't wait till the end of the show.
That is ridiculous. I am professional throughout the entire show.
A very busy program today.
Paul McCain,
he certainly put a twist on sexuality and gender, didn't he?
He sure did. And you know what? I love Jimmy's interview. That he was the author of A Sapper's War. That was so interesting in terms of the, you know, the Aussie diggers going up there. Which, an amazing story, and it's a great book.
Can you just move that box away? Because he's going for the blood oranges now as well. Michelle was really good in the kitchen.
I tell you what, I'm making those crepes in the weekend. Are you?
I am indeed, and the Mind Food app is available, so for more details, jump onto mindfood.com. It's really cool, isn't it?
It sure is. Just head to the Apple Store and you can buy it.
Fantastic, and until next time, take care.
Yeah, have a good weekend.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking, was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia, produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington, and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.